Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station. Available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Thursday morning, June 10, 2010. It's now 7:01 a.m. Central Daylight Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good morning, everyone. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. Or send us your email anytime to comments@libertytalkradio.com. I also encourage you to get educated on economic issues. Go to Andy Sutton's website, sutton-associates.net. In his bi-weekly newsletter, Andy discusses economic issues and how they affect you. You can also listen to Andy's commentary on contraryinvestorscafe.com. Lastly, I would also like to remind our listeners to subscribe to our reminder service by visiting our website and clicking on the subscribe icon. Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome, and welcome to our special edition of Liberty Talk Radio. We once again will have Andy Sutton with us this morning. We had him about a month ago, and the reason why we had him back so quickly is because he's so darn good. I mean, that's very simple. And not only that, but things are happening so quickly. Everything seems to be accelerating, and quite frankly, I'm getting really concerned. I need clarification. I do read his newsletters, and I do have questions, you know, so it's a good time to ask those questions. We do invite our listeners to call in at any time. Don't worry about interrupting us. 646-652-4620. Andy Sutton is the chief investment strategist for Sutton & Associates. In his newsletter, he really does a great job of looking at the macroeconomic point of view and seeing where we are and what we should be concerned about. He takes a lot of the noise out of the news media. Right now, my concern is that, you know, all we hear is noise. Every once in a while, I will get on the phone, or get on at the pipe and watch TV. And after a while, all I do is get a headache. So maybe we can get some clarification. I think this is Andy on the phone now. Let's see if we can get him on. Good morning, Andy. Is that you?
Hi, Joe. How you doing?
Fine, Andy. And how are things with you?
I'm doing well. Speaking of headaches, I just watched a little bit of one of the major financial news networks, and now I have one.
Oh, you have one. Okay. Well, you know, we talked about what we're going to talk about today, and there really is so much. Let me start off by just ranting for a moment. It seems that everyone is confused, including myself. News comes out of Europe, for example, that the Prime Minister of Germany is considering doing something, and worldwide markets go wild. They accelerate. Everyone's happy. All our ills are solved. There's no more problems in the world. I mean, that's the impression that you get. And yet, absolutely nothing has changed. All person did was yap a few words and says, well, maybe we'll do this. And it seems like the entire aura of our financial condition worldwide has been solved by those few words. But when you look at it more closely, nothing has changed. We have these ups and downs. This is about driving me nuts. I don't watch television anymore. I don't watch the CNBC news or anything. I haven't watched them in years because I always consider that just a lot of noise. And all I want to know is, really, what is the true state of affairs? Where are we? And where do we think that we are going instead of hearing all this noise? Can you help me?
Well, what you have is a lot of propaganda on these news channels. And I think this is one of the reasons, Joe, why there's a historic distrust for government and for media, because you have a situation where you've got, I'm not going to say everybody, but a lot of people are experiencing one set of economic, financial, and social realities, and they're being told that that in fact isn't happening and that things are really great and that there's this huge global recovery. You can't pick up a news article that has anything to do with geopolitics or finance or economics that doesn't have the words global recovery in it.
Right.
And that's like a Goebbels lie. It really is. I've talked to people in manufacturing, particularly heavy equipment and industrial good manufacturing, from managers down to line workers, and every one of them, to a man and woman, has told me that this is nothing more than inventory building, and it's probably going to end in the next couple of months, because what happens is during a recession, these firms work down their inventories.
Right.
And when they get to a certain level, they have to replenish them, and that's what they've been doing. So there's really a defined point in time during the first leg of any recession that people start to produce things again, and then they'll call back workers and start to build that inventory. But if you don't see a significant increase in aggregate demand for those goods, you're going to end up going, and that's why they call it a double dip recession. You're going to end up dipping down again.
Right.
There's going to be no demand for the products. The firms are going to have to lay people off again, and you kind of start the whole cycle over again. And this is where I think the government is all wet in terms of this Keynesian stimulus nonsense. They think that, we can hire census workers and we can lie to people and say, unemployment is fine and all of this kind of stuff, and we're going to hire these census workers. Well, they don't produce anything. I have never seen in my entire life, now granted, I haven't had that many censuses to go through, but I have never seen this much hyperbole and fanfare over the hiring of census workers. I mean, this is ridiculous.
Right.
But this is what's going on, and I think it plays right back to what you were saying, and it serves to really confuse people, where people are experiencing one thing and hearing that it should be something else, and then, in fact, it is something else. So I think, that's a lot of the reason why people don't trust the government and people don't trust the media. And I think it's one of the reasons why, what you and I do and so many others do is becoming more and more important, because I think people are starting to thirst for that. That kind of, and I won't call it an alternative, media style. I'm going to call it, people that have boots on the ground, that don't have a dog in the fight, and are just looking to do some honest reporting.
Right, and I like that, don't have a dog in the fight, because I don't. I mean, I don't even have any advertisers, and I'll call the shots the way they are. I have no vested interest either way. If things go fine, I'm fine. If things don't go fine, I'm going to get hurt with a lot of other people. Hopefully not as much. Hopefully I'm protecting myself. And that's this is all I'm telling people. I do have a distrust personally for just about everything that I hear these days. It is so incredibly difficult to find out exactly where we are. And what is really interesting is that I have literally stopped talking to people when they ask me my opinion, to give my opinion, because they look at you like you're absolutely stark raving mad. And I do not understand. I don't understand that disposition. Like, what do you mean? I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, they are been so attuned to being educated by television that anyone who disagrees with television has got to be a stark raving mad maniac. I mean, obviously you should be committed. And I don't even know why they want it. And it's not very often that people want to even get in this conversation today. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think before we go any further, you and I should pass out the tinfoil.
Yeah, that's yeah. It's exasperating, and I don't mind someone saying, I don't agree with you because I have no problem with that, but this aura of disbelief,
yeah, sure,
looking at you and agreeing with you, tacitly agreeing with you, and knowing in their minds are saying, this guy is mad. I hope he won't kill me. Yeah, I hope I'll get out of this conversation alive. They always have this look on their face, and then you stop talking. You say, why am I saying anything? Why did I even answer this person's question? It's almost as if I want to know the answer, but please don't tell me the answer. I just want to hear what I hear on TV. I want it confirmed, and that's all they want to hear. Anyway, on your last newsletter, you mentioned the M3 supply was going down precipitously. And one of the largest drops since, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, the Great Depression or something like that. It's been a long time. Now, I thought the M3 money supply being the total money supply out there, everything out there, it being reduced would be good and not bad. Could you elaborate on that for me?
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically what you have is M3 is the broadest of the monetary aggregates that we use in this country. Now, Britain has, they go one step further, and they have an M4, but that's their way they set up their metrics. Our M3 is, you know, if you're going to look at, you know, inflation and all of that stuff, that's the aggregate that you really want to pay attention
right.
to, because that's the total money supply. A lot of people will pick and snipe and say, well, you know, you should be paying more attention to M1 or M2 because that's spendable money and all that stuff. And, well, you know, that is, there's a certain component to that, and it is, you know, there is a certain amount of truth to that. When you're looking at, I'm talking about overall aggregate large-scale trends, you want to be looking at the broadest aggregate, and that's M3. Well, back in 2007, the Fed stopped reporting M3. And they did it at the time to save the taxpayers money, which is pretty much as much of an intellectual slap in the face as they could have possibly delivered, given what they've blown
incredible.
Of the taxpayers'
it's
money.
Yeah, they don't want to spend the money to.
But when you see M3, decrease like this, what you have there is really, from a monetary perspective, a genuine deflation. And you're right. There's if there's deflation, what you have is you have currency becoming more valuable. And you're seeing this even at the consumer level in a lot of areas. Take housing, for example. 2 years ago, a dollar would have bought, like 1/300,000th of a house.
Right.
And today it buys, 1/240,000th of a house. So the dollar has gained purchasing power
right.
in that particular area. You know, housing is obviously a big one.
Right.
And there's many other areas that this has happened, like electronics, and that's generally a technology trend.
Right.
But it's another example, where the dollar buys more. But what you would see in a genuine deflation is across the board, the dollar would be more valuable because there wouldn't be as many dollars. Now, what the problem here is our economy is not set up to run in a genuine fashion. It's set up to run in an inflationary environment. You know, we've
right.
had basically a 5% inflation rate, and I'm talking money supply growth,
right.
institutionalized in our monetary system for about the last 80 or 90 years.
Right.
There's been a couple of periods of time where that hasn't played out, but that's generally, if you average it out, that's about what we've got.
Right.
And that's how our economy is set up to grow. It's set up to grow on inflation. It's set up to grow on debt. You see a contraction in either one of those two things, and our economy is going to have a very difficult time growing because it's not set up to run in an authentic, genuine fashion, where you focus on savings, investment, capital production, those types of things. You're focused on consumption.
Right.
So under normal, genuine economic circumstances, deflation would be a good thing.
Right.
But in our system, it's really not, and that's something you really want to pay attention to. If M3 continues to collapse, and doesn't even need to collapse, if it continues to shrink, we're going to have an increasingly difficult time having any kind of economic growth. And this is one of the things where, you take a look at what the government is doing, and you look at GDP, and you look at government spending, and if you start looking at those things honestly, you realize that we really haven't had any growth for quite a while now.
Right, that's correct.
Despite what the media has to say about these things. So that's kind of like a 5-second version of where M3 plays in, and it's one of the things I watch. Another thing I watch on that front is consumer credit and those types of things, and there's a very, very tight relationship between consumer credit and economic growth. There's a very tight relationship between M3 growth and economic growth. So at the 35,000 foot level, if you're starting to talk about, I want to see what the major longer term trends are going to be, those are the things you want to watch. Now, on the shorter term, I'll take a look at M1 and M2 velocity,
right.
and that's basically turnover of the money
right.
supply, how many times the money was spent
yes.
in a particular period of time. And that's kind of a better indicator of shorter term activity because those are shorter term duration monetary instruments like checkable deposits, cash, those types of things.
Yeah, my wife keeps the velocity of money going very fast, by the way.
So you can look at those indicators as kind of a shorter-term way of assessing what is going on in the economy. But I like to look at the whole picture and figure out, where things are going short-run, medium-term, and then even the longer-term with those M3 aggregates kind of the consumer credit and those types of things.
Well, where do you get the M3 figure since it's not published anymore?
There's a couple of folks that actually reproduce it. Now, the components of M3 are actually still available. There's a fellow named John Williams. He does a pretty good job of reassembling the M3. And there's another outfit. The chart that I used in my essay is called NowInFutures.com. They have all sorts of monetary information. It's not just M3, but they've reconstructed it as well. And they actually boast 5 nines worth of correlation with the M3 between their recalculation and what the Fed was releasing up until 2007. So there's no reason to believe that these measurements aren't accurate because except for a very, very, very small component, everything's generally available. It's already been published as it is, and that's why the Fed stopping their release of that statistic was such a joke.
Yeah, yeah. Folks, it's 16 minutes past the hour of 7, and this is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. With us this morning, we're pleased to have Andy Sutton, Chief Investment Strategist for Sutton & Associates, and we're talking about the economic affairs of this world. I'm confused. I'm sure you are, too. If you have any questions, please call in 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. On occasion, I get emails that I would love to have called in, but I didn't want to interrupt you. You can interrupt us, and don't worry, your phone number will appear on my computer, and then I will click it at the appropriate time, so call in any time. Andy, would not the reduction of M3 hurt the government because it makes it more expensive for them to or more difficult to pay off their debts?
Well, see, this is the situation that you have there. I mean, this is one of the things that people often ask. You know, doesn't this hurt the government? And the answer to that is really, in the long run, it can hurt the government. But really, when you think about it, that debt is like an albatross, and it can't be paid as it is.
Right.
There was a lot of fanfare earlier this week. There was a couple of big articles and some mainstream websites about our debt approaching 100% of GDP. And people are acting like all of a sudden this is a problem. And it's like, when you get to 100%, then suddenly there's a problem. Wasn't 95% a problem?
Right.
You know, this has been going on for years.
Right.
And we've paid no attention to this debt. And it's not even just the debt, Joe. It's the promises that we've made that can't be paid. We don't have the revenues to pay these promises, and that's becoming more and more popular. I think you had Larry Kotlikoff on a couple of weeks ago.
That's correct.
And I'm sure he talked about this.
Right.
That's one of his main areas of focus, is this whole area of generational accounting and the unfunded liabilities and the huge problem that it's creating. I mean, I've pretty much reached the point, Joe, where I don't believe this debt can be paid off at all. I don't even think that it's possible to inflate fast enough to pay the debt off. And that's kind of why I think what we're going to see is some sort of a de facto default here at some point. And I believe they're also going to cap the money supply. And that'll solve most of the problems with one fell swoop. The biggest problem it won't solve, however, is economic growth.
Right.
Money will become more valuable because there's not going to be enough of it. And that seems like heresy in today's world. Everybody's been conditioned to believe that we're going to have hyperinflation, and I don't see it happening. It could happen, certainly, but I'm kind of thinking that that's probably not going to be the way it works out. And I'm gauging that by what's going on in Europe. I'm looking at Greece, and I'm looking at Spain, and now Hungary, and there's a whole bunch of these countries, and there's about 20 of them in all, the U.S., Great Britain included, much of the Western European bloc, that are going to have these fiscal problems. You know, their debt ratios are too high. There's too much deficit spending. They have too much social insurance, welfare state-type programs. And we've all kind of used this Keynesian model that we can stimulate economic growth in the long term by just spending money and borrowing and not even paying attention to the consequences of that. And there is a finite point in time where that ball game ends. And we're starting to reach that finite point in time where the ball game ends.
Okay.
And it's ending in Europe first. It's going to end here shortly. It's going to end in Great Britain shortly. And that's going to take care of quite a bit. But the problem here, I mean, to answer your question, will this hurt the government? I don't think the government's even concerned about paying off the debt. I really don't. You know, you look at that $13.5 trillion, whatever we're up to today,
right.
And... you look at that and you look at what the government's doing every year, there's massive deficits. So that means there's no payoff for the next 10 years. I mean, the CBO has released a bunch of studies saying that we're going to have these, you know, trillion-dollar deficits for the next 10 years. Well, that means we're spending more than we're bringing in. That means there's going to be no way, no ability, no mechanism for paying down even one penny of that debt. I don't think they're even thinking about paying it off.
Well,
I don't think it hurts them because they don't. I don't believe that paying off the debt is even in the cards. I think this is going to they're going to run them into the wall and then they're going to default.
You know, saying that, you know, being 95% of debt being 95% of GDP, we didn't worry about it, but now it's approaching 100. Now it's critical. Reminds me of that comedian. I forgot his name. He had passed away a few years ago. He was a big, heavy guy, and I never forget. He opened up one act by, you know, when he got on stage, and he said, "You know, I got up this morning and I looked at myself in the mirror. I said, God, I got fat." And obviously he's been big, you know, for 30 years. And, you know, it's like Wednesday he got fat. And it reminds me of the same thing. So when you said that, it reminded me of that comedian. I'm confused. If we're going to go through deflation, but we continue to rack up the debt, and that we go into debt, what, X billions of dollars a day that we add on to the debt. And I forgot what the figure was. It's a phenomenal amount of money every single day. And I sort of chuckle when the government says, well, we did this and it saved $32 million. And yet the debt for that day was, $50 billion or something, you know, just the add-on of the debt. With all this add-on of debt and deflation, my mind doesn't operate properly. I mean, we have more debt, but we have a deflationary environment. Could you help me understand how that works and what happened? I mean, when's the come to Jesus meeting on this thing? I mean, it doesn't seem to make any sense.
No, it doesn't. And this is one of what you would have is a situation where you've got hyperinflation to a point. And the thing that I'm worried about, and this is where this M3 comes in to the picture, if that continues to fall. Now, we've only seen, I mean, that, you saw the chart. If that continues to drop off, you're going to have an inability to pay the debts just because there's not going to be enough money in the system to do so. And that's why I'm saying it's going to be a de facto default where there's not enough money to pay the debt. With that, I believe, is going to come a situation where there's going to be a massive restructuring of Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, all these social insurance programs. And this is where it's going to hurt. Because you have so many people that are dependent on these programs. And they're dependent on these programs because of years of inflation at a certain level.
Right.
And that's going to hurt when they have to do that. And they're going to have to do that. I mean, it's called austerity. And you're hearing this with regards to Greece and some of the other countries in Europe. We're in the same boat they are. And that's what I think the media is not telling people. Is that, you know, they're kind of making it sound like, well, we get a get out of jail free card because we issue the world's reserve currency and we can do whatever we want economically and there's never any consequences because this is America and nothing bad ever happens here. And that's generally the take-home message that you get from the media.
Right.
This country, America, is no different than Greece.
Right.
We will have to embrace austerity at some point. It's the end of the cycle. It's the end of the debt cycle. This will not go on much longer, just because it's not sustainable. It never was, and they knew that from the beginning.
Right.
You know, Maynard Keynes, when he came up with his, Keynesian nonsense of, you know, spending deficit money and, doing this kind of government nonsense and other kind of stuff, somebody asked him, well, what about in the long run? What happens in the long run? And he knew. He said, we're all dead in the long run. So in other words, don't care.
Don't worry.
It doesn't matter because we're all going to be dead. So
that's
it shouldn't,
right.
You know, just do it because we should do it in the short term.
That's,
you know,
right.
For today. That
Overdrink, take drugs, do anything you want because you're going to die anyway. I mean, that's the attitude.
Exactly.
It's great. Yeah.
Exactly.
What is a person to do? I mean, people have money in the bank. They have 401k plans. Obviously, if there's some sort of devaluation, that we don't know what's going to happen with your investments. People are investing in precious metals like silver and gold. Who's going in the right direction and the wrong direction based on these figures now?
Well, I think basically what people need to do is, we don't actually know what's going to happen for sure. I mean, this is what I think is going to happen, but I'm going to say right now, that may not end up being the case. You might see them try to burn this thing out through hyperinflation. That'll be nasty. What I suggest for people, and this is, you know, one of the things we've been doing with clients, is we're trying to leave a wide footprint here, really, and prepare as best as we can for all of these scenarios and try to weight them based on probabilities. I mean, that's really what you can do at this point, is it's risk management based on probability analysis. And you take, you know, the situation with M3, you know, that rings up a point in the deflationary column. And you take up the austerity that's going on in Greece, and that goes for a point in the the decrease of the standard of living column. You know what I mean? And you take all these little things that are going on around the world and here and everywhere, and you try to paint a picture of what the most likely scenarios are to happen. And then what you do is you prepare for those scenarios in proportion to the probability that you think they have of actually coming to pass. Right. And it's something that is done in business, when you manage risk in a business, right, or in some kind of financial setting. Risk management is actually becoming quite a buzzword these days, in the financial world. You know, when students are going through their graduate financial programs now, they actually take classes on risk management. And this is exactly what it is, trying to figure out what the most likely outcomes are and then preparing for those outcomes in proportion to the likelihood of them happening. And that's really what you have to do. So if you're a Main Street, that's a terrible answer, by the way, but if you're a Main Street and you have a little portfolio and maybe you have a house and you owe some money on a mortgage, I would say that the first thing you want to do is try to get out of debt. Now, in a hyperinflationary scenario, if you have a fixed-rate mortgage,
right, you're okay.
You know, that might end up being the wrong move,
yeah,
because you're going to have more and more money if it trickles down in wages,
right,
if you see, we haven't seen that.
Yeah.
That's not been going on. I mean, the wages have not been keeping up with inflation for quite a long time now, and that kind of rings up a point in the you better pay off your debt column. You know what,
right,
I'm saying?
Right.
So I think relieving oneself of debt is going to be a solid move. If we have a deflation, you might not have enough money to pay off your debts.
Right.
You might run into,
right,
the same,
that's
problem,
right,
that the government's running into. They can default. You can't. You're going,
right,
to lose your house.
Right.
You're going to have your car repossessed, whatever the case may be. See, the government doesn't really worry about that as much. So, you know, paying off debt is a good thing. And what I'm going to tell people, and this, people aren't going to like this, and probably a bunch of people are going to turn the show off when I say this, you better cut your living standard now. You better get used to living on a smaller scale than you were living before. And I know, Americans love to live big. They like big,
right,
vacations. They like fancy cars. They,
right,
like all of these things. I have a sneaking suspicion that most of the people that listen to your show probably aren't like that.
Right.
But you want to start living simpler now, because it's easier to do it on your own than it is to have it jammed down your throat.
Right.
And whatever the situation is, whether it's hyperinflation or deflation, if it's hyperinflation, Joe, I don't see wages keeping up with prices, so you're going to fall further behind,
right,
anyway. If it's deflation, you're not going to have the money supply available to do these,
right,
these big grandiose things that we do now. So either way, I think cutting living standard voluntarily and making decisions now to do those things is a sound strategy. You're going to want to have some of your money. You want to, you know, divest yourself to the whatever degree comfortable from paper assets. You know, people always talk about diversification in terms of stocks and bonds and derivatives, options, whatever. You want to get some of that money out of paper, too, because we've found out and we've seen, and if people don't believe me by now, they never will, this whole paper system is suspect. It's not just,
right,
the debt. You,
right,
know, you have hundreds of trillions of dollars in these derivatives that are out there, and that's just a bomb waiting to go off. And there's so many things that are going on in the paper markets. You want to be very careful about that. So you want to diversify yourself. You want to get into, you know, some silver and gold. And a lot of people are going more towards silver right now. One, because it's cheaper, and two, because it's more fungible.
Right.
And if we do run into a situation where you need to use that as you know, trading, pablum or whatever, as money, you'll have a lot more coins if you're buying silver than if you're buying gold. And some of the mints are actually getting on the bandwagon here, and they're minting these little bars that you they're scored, and you can snap them into quarter ounce pieces for bartering. So you're seeing a lot of people starting to go that way. They're starting to go into junk silver and doing those kinds of things.
Yeah.
So you want to cast a wide footprint, and if you have paper assets, you want to try to squeeze the most out of them in the present as you can, and that's one of the things that we specialize in here, is squeezing the most out of these markets in the short term.
Right.
And you know that's whether we're hunting down distributions, interest, whatever the case may be. I'm not so much a long-term investor anymore. I like solid basic businesses based on viable economic themes, but at the same time, I'm recognizing that I think our world's going to be changing dramatically over the next several years,
Good point.
As such, I want to get as much out of this as I can now.
Right.
So I
right.
think those are some solid strategies that people can kind of undertake to help them prepare for what's going to be happening. And those strategies, I think, will serve you no matter what the outcome happens to be, whether it's inflation, hyperinflation, or deflation.
Right. Folks, it is now 31 minutes past the hour of 7. We have, well, this is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We are pleased today to have with us Andy Sutton, Chief Investment Strategist for Sutton & Associates. We're talking about the economy and how it affects you. Please call in 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. Know you're out there. Don't be afraid to call in. You're not interrupting us. Of course, you can send us your comments anytime to comments@libertytalkradio.com. Andy, I was reading the American Institute of Economic Research latest report, and all of the leading indicators, lagging indicators, and some, I think, two-thirds of the coincidence indicators were in positive territory. And not much, just very slightly, very anemically, but they were in positive territory. However, they do mention things as, such as jobs, you know, manufacturing inventories and stuff like that are either going down or are suspect. In other words, the real meat and potatoes, you know, doesn't seem to be there. But all the indicators are up. What do you make of that?
Well, see, this is another situation. This is what I was talking about before, but I'm glad you got to this because this is a more specific example of this. When you're looking at inventories, and the Beige Book yesterday said basically the same thing, spending on inventories is starting to wane, and this kind of fits in with what I've been hearing from people in the heavy equipment and you know, industrial good manufacturing sectors now for a couple months. These are areas in jobs. These are areas, Joe, that stimulus didn't reach, basically, for lack of a better term. You know, yeah, they put some people to work on highways and doing some stuff and that kind of thing. And, you know, they're groundhogging it up here and digging holes and filling them and that kind of
right.
stuff. You know, make work sorts of things. But when you look at it on an aggregate fundamental level, the economy itself has not been stimulated. Certain segments were. But not in general. And this is where you have to, when you look at these indicators, it's just like GDP, and this is something I've talked about in the 2 Cents series for a while now. You have to take into account the effect of the government spending, because the government spending is not genuine. If we were China and we had these huge, huge reserves, this big piggy bank that we had to work off, and we could spend it into the economy to try to stimulate it, that would be one deal. That would be one situation. That would be one thing. But we're not doing that. We don't have a piggy bank. Our piggy bank is empty. And what we're doing is we are borrowing money and adding to our debt to try to stimulate the economy. So therefore, it's not genuine spending. It's not
right.
genuine investment.
Right.
It comes with a liability attached to it.
Right.
So I've always argued we should not count government spending that arises from debt creation as part of GDP. And, oh,
right.
I've been sniped at for that because, well, it's still spending and it does create a job. And tell that to the bridge worker who's working now and not
yeah,
collecting
right.
unemployment
yeah.
because
right.
the government borrowed money. And my
that.
Response is always, what is he going to do when the bridge is fixed?
Right.
They haven't stimulated anything. And what they've done is they've borrowed a bunch of money to create some short-term happiness. And this is a lot of this... with regards to the leading coincident and lagging economic indicators, is a manifestation of this. You know, you have to try to look at these things and remove that fraudulent government stimulus from them. And once you do that, you know, we've removed it from GDP and it paints an ugly picture. You start going in there and removing it from some of these other indicators, it creates an ugly picture. So that's kind of where I stand on that whole situation, and I'm very skeptical of the Beige Book, and I'm very skeptical of the Conference Board's Index of Leading Economic Indicators, just because so many of them are susceptible to this, you know, this spent government money that's originating from more debt creation.
Yeah.
And this is another thing that tells me they're not even worried about debt. I mean, we've got massive deficits again this year. And all of that, and the economy still is not recovering.
Well,
jobs
yeah,
are still
I,
terrible.
Yeah,
you know, they can hire census workers, and that,
right.
You know, it's, you know what I'm saying.
Right. Well, you know, just the other day, I just heard on radio or something, and someone said the jobs situation looks good, where jobs are being reduced as government and in the healthcare industry. And boy, I almost slammed on the brakes on my car. I said, reduced in the healthcare industry and government and improving every place else? Now, she didn't give any figures. You know, she just said it's improving. And she said, we can anticipate, you know, more jobs in the private sector and all that. And that just did not sound right to me, because I know in the healthcare industry, they're hiring like crazy. I mean, just because the population is aging and we need more and more people in that arena. I can't see that decreasing, and government jobs decreasing. I can't see that either. I mean, I haven't heard anything other than a general comment in that regard. Is there any validity to those comments?
Let me talk about the government situation first. I was contacted a number of weeks ago by an individual who was a manager in the census operation, and he gave me enough details to that I believe that he was who he said he was. And what he told me, Joe, is that the government hiring for the census has been subcontracted out for the most part to a private company.
Right.
So the census workers are paid by the private company.
Right. So
they're
jobs,
not being paid by the government.
Right.
And as such, those jobs were attributed to the private sector.
Right.
Because they were actually hired by a private sector operation. So
right.
It's a subcontracting situation. Now, apparently, some of these workers are actually government employees as well, whether they're field managers or supervisors or whatever the situation is. First of all, I have never seen such an effort to conduct a census. I mean, this is kind of, you know, going back to Caesarian times where, you know, you had to pack your family up and take them back to the home city like Mary and Joseph had to do.
Right,
you know,
right.
I mean, you're talking about some serious stuff here. I've never seen such a census operation. That aside, what we're seeing, so that kind of gives you a view into what's going on with the jobs on the government side, because if you take that information, you say, all right, let's assume this guy is telling the truth, and I have no reason to believe he's not. Let's assume that this is true. You look at the number of private sector jobs that were created during the first part of this year. That almost lines up one for one with the amount of census workers that were hired by this outfit.
Right.
So there really has not been, outside of that, a lot of private sector hiring. And we've been waiting for private sector jobs for a year now. You know, Bernanke's saying, well, you know, they're coming, but not soon. The government, you take a look at state and local governments, Joe, they're cutting workforces like crazy.
Right. That's
so
true.
So she may have been talking about that.
Okay.
Because that is happening.
Andy, let me
you know, a lot of these
Andy,
states are broke, locals are broke.
No, let me interrupt you. We've had a caller on the line holding for some time. I just want to interrupt you because I don't want to lose the caller, okay? Let's get this caller on the line.
No, that's fine. Go right ahead.
I apologize. All right. Caller, area code 918, you're on the air.
Hello, Joe, Andy. This is Jim in Tulsa.
Hey,
enjoyed
Jim.
Listening to the conversation this morning. And Andy, if you would like to finish your thought before you answer my question, that's fine, because it's on another topic, and that being, it's been now over 50 days since this tragedy in the Gulf has begun, and obviously it's been headline news for a long time. From an investor's point of view, how do you see things unfolding with both BP and the oil and energy sector as a whole. And would you have any advice for investors that have positions in the oil energy sector, or would you suggest people to stay away with due to the uncertainty? Just would like your thoughts as to this whole all this mess down there.
Well, obviously, and that's a good question, Jim. Obviously, BP has been beaten up pretty badly, and the liability for this is going to be a huge problem for BP. I think there's going to be a big turf war between BP and the federal government over who's going to pay for what. And one of the things that's already been floated around is this tax on every barrel of oil, like an oil well tax or an oil field tax or something like that. So I think, net, this is bad for consumers. As far as some of the different stocks go, I mean, BP obviously is a stay away from right now, in my book, just because of the fact, the yield's up around 11%, but there's so much uncertainty out there. There's going to be litigation. I bet on that. That's almost a guarantee. They're probably going to have to pay out, so that's going to negatively impact the stock. Same goes for Transocean and Halliburton, too. They're involved also. To what level, who gets blamed and who gets held responsible and who actually has to shell out cash? We don't know that yet, and that all gets flung up in the uncertainty column. So, if you're one of those people that has a holding in one of those positions, you can make a choice. A lot of people already got out, obviously. The stock's been falling like a stone. But if you're in there, and you really have a really, really, really long-term horizon, maybe you stick around. There's a lot of nasty technical patterns on BP stock right now. That to me would be a stay away from. As far as the whole sector goes, nothing has really changed as far as, oil demand and all of that stuff. That's been totally unaffected by this spill, and it was a relatively small well in terms of supply. It wasn't like it was a Ghawar or a Canarel or something like that where they had a major problem and it's going to impact global supply. It can cause a lot of problems ecologically and environmentally, but you're not going to see an impact on global supply because of this. I think that, as a theme, the sector is still good, and this is a chance where, these things do get beat up because of somebody else's problems. There might be some opportunities in there to step into the higher yield and pull cash out of this market at this particular point in time. But that's a good question. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of fallout, and that's kind of what I think the bottom line is at this point, Jim.
Right. So what about buying puts on BP?
Well, I don't think it's really appropriate to give specific recommendations just because I don't know what people's suitability is. If somebody wants to gamble on the downside, that's certainly a way that they could do it. That's viable. It's probably a better thing than actually going short. But if you want to bet on something going down, that is one way to do it.
Jim, stay on the line just for a second, Jim. Andy, what about the overall economy of the Gulf region as a result of this? There's obviously going to be a lot of money pumped in by the government to help clean up, et cetera, which is going to add to the debt situation. How will this, do you see it affecting the general economy of that area?
Well, it's already affected it. There's a lot of offshore operations, whether it's fishing or I believe they do a lot of shrimping down there.
Right.
Those types of things. Those folks are already being affected. I think, the fishermen and whatnot got $5,000 from BP right at the beginning of this thing, and that's pretty much been used up. They've got leases on boats, equipment, they've got to pay their workers and all that kind of stuff. So this is going to have a pretty big impact right along the Gulf Coast, obviously. Tourism could be hit, if these beaches around that area get a bunch of oil washed up on them, that's going to chase tourists away. So, you could have a pretty widespread economic plague caused by this, really. I'm not sure how far inland that'll go. I see it causing a lot of problems for sure right at the oceanfront areas. That could even stretch in there. We just don't know yet. There's not enough empirical data that's escape on this whole situation. You have to make really a quantitative assessment of that. I'm just kind of, you know, going through the, you know, what's going on here and trying to think about what this could actually affect. I mean, they're talking about this coming up the East Coast. If that happens, you know, you could see some of the East Coast beaches affected. I mean, we just don't know yet. It's too early. My take on this is that it's going to be very significant, though.
Okay. Jim, you have any other questions for our guest?
No, just Andy, I too had heard that the oil spill might work its way up the East Coast, and I was contemplating going up to Cape Cod in late August, and we've made alternative plans because of that uncertainty. But that aside, I think your comments on the whole situation and just the amount of uncertainty as to how this is going to unfold. But it's tragic, and I appreciate your thoughts, and always enjoy your emails and your commentary, and glad Joe's got you back on the air. Thanks again.
Oh, thanks a lot, Jim. Appreciate that.
Bye.
Thank you, Jim.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. Bye.
I heard yesterday, and it was in passing, and I can't put my finger on it. Bernanke said something about our debt being $19 trillion. Did you hear that, Andy?
Yeah, they're talking by 2015.
Oh, okay.
All right.
That's the part that I missed. Yeah.
That's only 4 years away, really, when you think about it in terms of fiscal years. He's not even mentioning, and this is where it goes back to the unfunded, and this is the big problem. You know, those future promises continue to rack up, and nothing has been done. Congress is not even aware. They're aware of it, but they're not politically aware of this yet. And this is something that nobody is going to want to touch. And this is why I think we default, Joe, because I'm looking at this from a human nature standpoint. You know, if you're a politician, what politician in his or her right mind is going to stand up in front of the American people and say, you're going to have to tighten your belts. All those Social Security monies that you paid into the system, you're not going to get those back because your government blew the money and squandered it. All those drugs that Medicare helps you pay for right now, you're going to have to pay for those yourself. All those hospital stays, doctor's visits, and everything else, x-rays, diagnostics, whatever, you're going to have to pay for more of those yourself because your government tried to run the world and tried to do things better than the private sector. And, by the way, vote for me. I mean, seriously, outside of a guy like Ron Paul, you know, and he pretty much stood up and said exactly that.
Right.
They're a bunch of solenterates for the most part in Congress. I don't see a political will to stand up and do this until it becomes apparent that the whole debt cycle is over and we run into the debt wall, if you will. And that's why I think we're going to default, because I don't think there's the political will to do anything about it until it's forced upon us. That's just the way I see it, and there's plenty of history to back me up. We don't proact, we react.
Right, we
and
always react.
I don't see any reason to believe why we won't do that here.
Right. Folks, it's about 12 minutes before the hour. We have with us, this is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We have with us today Andy Sutton, Chief Investment Strategist for Sutton & Associates, and we are talking about the thing that's on everyone's mind. What the heck is going on with our economy? We talk about the monetary aspects of the economy, but really that translates into the social aspects. For example, in many areas, where there are large cities, older cities, employment rates are now escalating past 50%. That's unemployment at past 50%. There is going to be a trigger point, where food stamps or whatever it is, government money peters out or gets reduced or gets stopped or whatever the case may be. And there's going to be unemployed, and people that are collecting unemployment now, their unemployment checks are going to be ending soon. How do you foresee? I'm going to ask you to prophesize a little bit. How do you see the social impact? Are there any trigger points that you see? You see any danger here? I mean, other than just people being out of jobs, being frustrated and looking for a job. I mean, that's the way we look at it, you know, when we're not in that dire straits. But there are a lot of people in dire straits. From the social impact point of view, where do you see us going?
I'm going to steal a line from Gerald Celente. He's a trend researcher.
Yes,
and it says, when people have nothing left to lose and they've lost everything, they lose it. And I don't see anything being more accurate than that. And this is something that I think is a real concern for people. And I don't want to scare people, but at the same time I do. Because anytime you have an economic situation where on a widespread level you have a handicapped ability to feed one's family, people get desperate. I mean,
right.
That's just
oh,
the way
yeah.
it is. People
Absolutely.
Have a survival instinct.
Right.
And, you know, the government has been papering over a lot of this with unemployment checks and food stamps. And Joe, you've got record amounts of people every month now on food stamps. That is just going through the roof. You've got states borrowing money now to pay unemployment benefits to keep that thing going. This thing's not going to go on much longer. And when people stop receiving those checks, or when those checks are not able, they've been reduced maybe, and they're not able to cover the basic necessities of life. You know, I heard from a listener to one of my shows that there's a national park down in Florida that's basically been cordoned off, and they have thousands and thousands and thousands of families living in tents in this national park because they got thrown out of their houses.
Yeah.
So these are the kind of things where I kind of get scared. I'll be honest with you. You know, you think about that and you think, all right, what's going to happen when the government can't make all these transfer payments
right.
to people, and they can't pay these unemployment benefits, and they can't do the food stamps and the welfare and all these other programs that we have come as a society to rely on?
Yeah.
I don't see good things happening as a result of that. I just don't. I mean, I'm tapping into my limited understanding of human nature and history and what's going on in other parts of the world. You know, you see the riots that are going on in Greece, and nobody's even starving yet.
Right. That's correct.
So
they're just angry that they're losing their benefits or whatever, or reducing benefits, right.
Yeah, that is very worrisome to me, and that's outside the economic realm. You know, now I'm talking more as a husband and a father
right.
in that situation. And that is very worrisome to me. And if you're living in, you know, one of these areas where you've got really, really high unemployment and a lot of people are on food stamps, and I think there's cause for concern there. I really do.
See,
and if you're able to you know, get away from that, I would think that might be a logical move at this point, just because I think the likelihood, you know, there's no guarantee. I'm not saying that, you know, we're going to have, you know, Mad Max or anything like that. But I think the likelihood of increased crime, and we're already seeing increased crime.
Yeah.
You know, I've talked to state police in this area. I know a couple of guys, and they said the media is not even reporting a lot of the home break-ins and home invasions and robberies and stuff that's going on. And that's in this area. And this is a pretty tame area of the country. So I do think there's cause for concern there.
Well, you can understand that if there is negative news being spouted on TV, with the way people feel, that could be a trigger point. In other words, it almost seems as if
sure.
we keep the optimistic news out there to keep things just above the, you know, away from the boiling point. Because I'm sensitive to that. 50 years ago, when I was lived in Harlem, New York, we had the riots, and I remember going to work with riot police with shields over our heads. So I know it can happen, and I know it gets really, really ugly and really mean. Most people have not experienced that, or they've just seen it on TV. I was in it, you know. It's not a pretty picture. Mark Faber gave a seminar for about almost an hour and a half, and he ended it when someone asked him what they thought they should do. He said, buy barbed wire and land someplace, you know. And he laughed, but I think he meant it. I really think he meant it. He says things don't look very, very, very good. Is it that there's computer algorithms that keep the stock market really humming the way it's going? Although it's down, I mean, the way things are going, you think people would be running for the hills. Why does the stock market maintain itself so well?
Well, really what you have here, Joe, is a situation where there's a very narrow level of participation. if you look at mutual fund total assets, and that's really the main way that the private,
right,
Joe and Mary Smith investors get into the market. Most of them buy mutual funds. Those levels are down. People have been withdrawing money from mutual funds in the aggregate. And so really what you have is what you said, black box program trading, and it's basically pay for shuffling between a lot of these big investment banks. The thing that I want to point out is, how can all of these banks be making, you know, billions of dollars in trading revenue? You know, for every winner in the stock market, there's a loser. It's a zero-sum game.
Right.
So who are the losers? Well, in my opinion, the losers are pension funds and those types of things. Some of the private 401k plans. You know, the private's been hammered. Wall Street recovered rather quickly. It's been, you know, the Joe and Mary Smiths that have really gotten creamed here as a result of all of this.
Yeah.
And but you still do have, you know, a lot of large investment companies that are in there, and the stock market is kind of an enigma right now. You look at it, it's down roughly 10%. We're under 10,000. Again, we're up around 11.2, so we've lost 10-11%, depending on the day. I look at the moves. I look at the technicals behind the moves. You take a look at a lot of these days, you're seeing the big rallies are at 3 o'clock, 3:15. You know, 3:30, those types of things. They're not, that's not, you know, mom-pa kettle digging in the sofa to find quarters to buy a share of, you know, whatever stock. You know, that's program trading and those types of things. That's why I said I think it's important for people to squeeze as much out of the markets as they can and not look to make money from capital appreciation. You know, look to make solid known money from dividends and distributions, interest on preferred, those types of things, just because of the fact that you can get it out now, you know it's coming, and it's a little bit more, a lot more really certain than, you know, buying for the long haul and saying, well, I'm going to buy this, it doesn't pay a dividend or anything like that, but, you know, I think in 5 years it's going to be higher. I think, you know, just buying for capital appreciation is the wrong approach to take right now.
Andy, we have about 3 minutes left. I want to give those 3 minutes to you for whatever you want to say. In fact, I can give you 2 minutes. I'll need a minute or so just to shut everything down and say goodbye to everybody and do my closing bit. So in the next 2 minutes, can you? I'll give to you to talk about your website, what you do, or whatever, however you want to end it.
Well, thank you, and just cut me off because I tend to ramble. I mean, basically what we do is we take a look at a lot of the stuff that we've talked about here over the last hour and try to distill that into a strategy that, you know, our clients can use to help them. You know, we're not looking to get people rich at this point, and people might say, well, what are you talking about? You know, everybody wants to get rich. We're looking to try to create a situation where people can maintain their standard of living, because that's what's really under attack here. And we're looking for a situation where we can use these different vehicles to create the best outcome for people and to try to create a situation where there's solid income, diversification across all asset classes, and generally preparation for, you know, austerity, de facto defaults potentially, hyperinflation on the other hand, and do all of those different types of things. That's really where we focus the efforts of our newsletter, you know, our paid newsletter, The Sensible Investor. We focus a lot of it on that, and also the services that we provide to, you know, our advisory and planning clients. That's what we do. You know, we're in that business, and it's not, you know, if we can make some nominal dollars, that's great, but we're looking to help people get through this what I believe is going to be a pretty significant adjustment in the American standard of living over the next few years. Well, and that's really the gist of what we do.
And your website is sutton-associates.net, correct?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, and you can find all the My Two Cents stuff is all there. There's information about the paid newsletter, and there's information about the advisory and planning services that we provide our clients as
well. Very good. Well, Andy, thank you so much for taking your time to be on our program today. It's been a pleasure. Love always hearing from you, getting your newsletter, and I read each one of them word for word. I think they're terrific. They're the best in the industry, and I thank you for it. And I thank you for being on our program this morning.
Joe, thanks for having me back. It's been great being on Liberty Talk Radio, and thank you for doing what you do.
All right, you take care now. Thank you very much. Bye-bye now.
All right. Bye now.
Boy, that was Andy Associates. He is good. He is good. I tell you, he is really good. This is the end of today's program. We'd like to thank Ranch Acres Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you're either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there is no middle ground. Ron Paul has a sign that says this is no steal. The government hates competition. With that, until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned.